Van Indemuiden, leaders of the Emidnight race who had remained loyal after the rebellion were asked to come down from their highland headquarters and recruit from 61 scattered settlements, a core of over 3,000 willing and enthusiastic workers to build the new Garden of Eden. From a possible choice of three selected sites, one that was finally chosen was on a long peninsula, almost an island, projecting westward from the eastern shores of the Mediterranean Sea and with a good warm climate. The neck of the Adenaic Peninsula was over 37 miles wide, and at the center an exquisite stone temple to the Trinity Father of the Grand Universe was constructed. Right in the heart of the temple was planted the Tree of Life brought over from the constellation of Norlaishadk's headquarters sphere, Adentia. The fruit of this tree had the properties of prolonging almost indefinitely the lifespan of the Adamic beings originating from Satania's headquarters world of Jerusalem. The Garden of Eden's administrative headquarters were established in the northern part of the peninsula and the homes for the workers and their families in the south. The plans laid for the Garden of Eden provided for enough homes and abundant land in a beautifully semi-tropical garden landscape to allow for an eventual total of 1 million inhabitants. By the time Adam and Eve arrived from the local system of Satania's headquarters sphere of Jerusalem over 37,000 years ago, the Garden of Eden was already one quarter finished, complete with irrigation ditches, paved roads and pathways. There would eventually be over 5,000 brick dwellings in the various sectors, each neighborhood locality allowing for only a maximum cluster of 7 in one area. They were all to be surrounded by great numbers of trees and plants and within the most beautiful garden landscaping. However, after their arrival and formal installation as the new rulers of Urantia, Earth, Adam and Eve soon became very aware of the planet's isolation from contact with other worlds. Silent were the familiar galactic broadcasts, and absent were all the circuits of extraplanetary communication. Their second day on Earth was spent in session with the planetary receivers, the Melchizedeks and their advisory council, who had been appointed provisional custodians of the planet. From them they learned the bitter news, that they were suffering the isolation imposed on Earth as a result of the Caligastia rebellion. Nonetheless, all went reasonably well for a time on Urantia, Earth under the new Adamic administration. It even appeared that Adam might gradually be able to develop a successful plan for the extension of the new Adenic civilization outwards amongst the surrounding primitive tribes. Adam and Eve had in fact been given a long training period on Jerusalem on all the techniques of improving a young world's readiness to accept a step up in evolutionary civilization. Now they had to face up to the pressing problems of establishing a rule of law and order in their surrounding world of savages, barbarians, and semi-civilized human beings. Unfortunately, apart from the cream of the Earth's population assembled in the Garden of Eden, only a few tribal groups here and there were at all ready for the reception of the new Adamic culture. Tribal development had been badly set back by the administrative disruption following the earlier Lucifer rebellion. Adam made a heroic and determined effort to institute representative government in place of a monarchical one, but he met with stubborn resistance at every turn and eventually had to abandon all efforts to do so. He had already put in operation a system of group control throughout the Garden of Eden itself and had federated all of these groups into the Adenic League. He also succeeded in establishing almost 100 outlying trade and social centers where selected individuals of a strong ability ruled in his name. But serious trouble always ensued when he ventured outside the Garden of Eden and sought to apply these ideas to the more distant outlying tribes. The moment Adam's associates began to work outside the Adenic area, they met the direct and well-planned resistance of Caligastia. Although the fallen prince had been deposed by the Constellation Fathers as Earth's ruling sovereign, he had not been physically removed from the planet, and this in fact was not done so until the time of Christ Michael's bestowal life on Earth 2,000 years ago. He was still able to some extent to encourage many primitive tribes to resist all of Adam's plans for the rehabilitation and upgrading of Earth's society. Caligastia, however, was allowed to pay frequent visits to the Garden of Eden in order to try and settle the differences between his leadership of the outlying tribes and the Adamic administration. Despite many conferences with Adam and Eve, Adam always remained opposed to any compromise, and the wily Prince Caligastia soon gave up trying to work directly on Adam and decided to try a subtle flank attack on Eve. He laid plans for entrapping Eve into committing a serious error by breaking the Adamic pledge never to procreate with any of Earth's indigenous mortals. Adam and Eve had completed their first 100 years on Earth, having produced 63 of their own children along with 1,647 grandchildren as their pure line descendants. It was at this time that Caligastia decided to set in motion a wily plot to undermine Adam's rule. It should be appreciated that Caligastia, having originated from a superior non-mortal race on Satan Ears Jerusalem, still had considerable powers to influence the thoughts and actions of Earth mortals, even those more advanced and progressive. It so happened that a senior tribal leader named Sarapatasha had just come into the leadership of the Western Osirian Confederation of the Nodite tribes upon the death of his father. Sarapatasha, who stood out as an unusually intelligent and advanced human mortal, had already made several visits to the Garden of Eden and had become deeply impressed with the righteousness of Adam's leadership and rule. Therefore, shortly after assuming the leadership of the Syrian Nodites, he announced his intention of establishing an affiliation with the work of Adam and Eve in developing and upgrading tribal administration. He put it to the Nodite Tribal Confederation that it was going to be to their greater benefit, and the Nodite tribe readily agreed to support him. It was shortly after this tribal acceptance that Sarapatasha and some of his new staff were invited and entertained by Adam and Eve in their own home in Eden. Sarapatasha thereafter became one of the most able and efficient of all Adam's lieutenants. He was entirely honest and thoroughly sincere in all of his activities. He was never conscious, even to the end, that he was to be used as a circumstantial tool against Adam and Eve in a clever plot set in motion through concealed mental suggestion by the wily Caligastia. The Fall of Eve. Soon Sarapatasha was appointed associate chairman of the Adenic Commission on Tribal Relations, and many plans were laid for the more vigorous prosecution of the work of winning the remote tribes to the Adamic cause. He thus held frequent conferences with Adam and Eve, especially with Eve, and one day, during a talk with Eve, a mental suggestion came to Sarapatasha that if the Nodites, as the most progressive and cooperative tribal race, could have a leader born to them incorporating the elevated genes of her non-mortal celestial race, it would constitute a powerful tie binding these people to the Garden of Eden. He was then mentally influenced to reason with Eve that if this child could be reared and educated in the Garden of Eden, it would exert a great influence over his people and possibly influence the many other tribes. For more than 5 years these plans were secretly progressed between them. At last they were developed to the point where Eve consented to have a secret conference with Sarapatasha's close associate, Kano, a most brilliant mind and the active leader of the nearby colony of the friendly Nodites. Kano was very sympathetic to the Adamic cause and was also the spiritual leader of this neighboring Nodite tribe, which had been amongst the first to choose to have friendly relations with the Garden of Eden. The fateful meeting occurred during the twilight hours of an autumn evening, not far from the home of Adam. Eve had never before met the beautiful and enthusiastic Kano, and he was a magnificent specimen of the superior physique and outstanding intellect of his remote descendants of the planetary prince's original staff. And Kano also thoroughly believed in the righteousness of the Sarapatasha project, since multiple mating was a common practice outside of the Garden of Eden and was not considered in any way to be wrong. Encouraged by flattery, enthusiasm, and great personal persuasion, Eve then and there consented to embark upon the much-discussed enterprise, to add her own contribution of world-saving to the divine plan. Before she quite realized what was transpiring, the fatal step had been taken and the deed was done. The child arising from this union was eventually to be named Cain. Adam, however, very soon sensed from Eve that something very seriously wrong had taken place. He asked Eve to come outside with him into their garden. And now for the first time Adam heard from Eve the entire story about her and Sarapatasha's long-nourished plan for accelerating world improvement by stimulating the upliftment of the tribal bloodstock and genes of one of the more advanced world tribes. And as they communed in the moonlit garden, they suddenly heard a discarnate voice in the garden reproving them for their disobedience. It informed them that they had transgressed the Garden of Eden covenant and had defaulted in the execution of their oaths of trust to the rulers of the local universe. Upon hearing this, Eve's disillusionment was truly pathetic. Adam had quickly taken in the whole predicament they were in, and whilst heartbroken and dejected, he nonetheless felt a great sympathy and pity for his erring mate. It was in Adam's despair at the realization of Eve's failure that the day after Eve's misstep, he sought out Lotta, a brilliant Noddite woman who was head of the Western schools of the Garden of Eden, in order to balance out Eve's great shame by committing the same act himself. He wished to deliberately share his beloved partner's fate. He loved his mate with a supermortal affection, and the thought of the possibility of a lonely vigil on Urantia without her was more than he could endure. Later, when the result of this union was the birth of a daughter named Sansa, and since Lotta died in the childbirth, Eve without hesitation took Sansa to her bosom, and she was reared along with Cain to grow up to be a woman of great ability. When the worker inhabitants of the Garden of Eden learned of what had happened to Eve, these infuriated inhabitants declared war on the nearby Noddite settlement. They swept out through the gates of Eden and down upon these unprepared Noddite people, utterly destroying them. Not a man, woman, or child was spared. Cano, the father of Cain yet unborn, also perished, and Sarapatea, overcome with remorse at what he had set in motion, drowned himself next day in the great river. But still more trouble was brewing. The news of the annihilation of the Noddite settlement near Eden was not slow in reaching the home tribes of Sarapatasha to the north, and presently a great host was assembling to march on the Garden of Eden. And this was to be only the beginning of a long and bitter warfare between the Adamite tribal followers and the Noddite tribes. Adam, having realized that he and Eve had failed in their Adamic mission, and not wishing to go to war with the tribes, agreed with 1,200 of his loyal followers to flee by caravan east to the second originally selected site for the Garden of Eden, at the confluence of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers in Mesopotamia. The flight to the second Eden. As the Edenic caravan proceeded on its way, Adam was not entirely certain how the hierarchy was going to react to their offense. On the third day of their journey, they were halted by the arrival of the seraphic hosts from Jerusalem, who formally informed Adam and Eve of their transgressions and advised them concerning their fate. Gabriel, the chief administrative officer of the local universe of Nubadn, had pronounced judgment from Nubadn's headquarters on Salvington to the effect that, although they were not being charged of standing in contempt of the universe government and had not been guilty of rebellion, they had degraded themselves to the lower status of mortals of the realm. They would no longer have immortality of life previously conferred on them along with their access to the restorative tree of life. From now on they must conduct themselves as a purely mortal man and woman of Urantia, now subject to a limited lifespan. They were henceforth to be totally dependent on any successful local development of Earth's tribal races for their own future well-being. It required almost a full year for the Edenic caravan to reach the Euphrates River. When word reached the existing dwellers at the site of the Second Garden of Eden that the king and high priest of the Garden of Eden was marching on them, they fled in haste to the eastern mountains. Adam found all of the desired territory totally vacated when he arrived. In this new location, Adam and his helpers were now obliged to adopt relatively crude methods of living, whereas the first Garden of Eden had already been prepared for them, whilst this new one thus had to be created by the labor of their own hands. Adam's caravan had had the foresight to carry the seeds and bulbs of hundreds of plants and cereals of the first garden to the land between the rivers. They also brought along extensive herds of animals as well as some of the more domesticated ones. Because of this, they at least possessed some advantages over the surrounding tribes, and eventually they were able to develop and enjoy many of the benefits of the previous culture of their first Garden of Eden. The site of Second Garden of Eden between the two great rivers was to provide a good natural defense from any marauding tribes. A short way to the north, where the Euphrates and Tigris came close together, a high defense wall was to be built between the rivers extending some 56 miles for the protection of the main body of the territory to the south. And so it was that they set themselves to building their own new homes and working from scratch to create a second beautiful Garden of Eden and eventually establish a new center on Earth of relatively advanced culture and religion. Up to the time of leaving the first Eden, Adam and his family had always subsisted on eating only fruits, cereals and nuts. On the way to Mesopotamia, they had for the first time been forced to partake of herbs and vegetables. Even though the eating of meat was eventually introduced into the second garden, Adam and Eve never partook of flesh as part of their regular diet. Neither did any of their first generation children of the original Eden become flesh eaters. They subsisted wholly upon the fruits and nuts of the trees. However, the next generation of Adamic descendants did begin to partake of dairy products, though they continued to follow a non-flesh diet. Many of the southern tribes with whom they later united were also non-flesh eaters. Later on, most of these vegetarian tribes migrated to the east and became mixed in with the peoples of India. The psychic abilities of Adam and Eve were far superior to those of present-day peoples. Their extrasensory senses were acute and they were able to see higher vibrational angelic hosts and other higher dimensional beings. This ability lasted them for over 100 years after the fall of the first Eden. These higher senses were not to be so strong in their second Garden of Eden offspring and tended to gradually diminish with each succeeding generation. Adam lived for a total of 530 years, 412 of them in the second Garden of Eden, and died 35,000 years ago of what might be simply termed old age. His physical mechanism eventually wore out, the process of disintegration gradually gaining on the processes of repair, and the inevitable end came. Eve had died 19 years previously of a weakened heart. They were both buried in the center of the Temple of Divine Service, which had been built in accordance with their plan soon after the northern Great Wall between the rivers of the colony had been completed. The final end of the first Garden of Eden Peninsula in the Mediterranean came almost 4,000 years after Adam and Eve had fled. It had been overrun and occupied at different times by the lower grade tribes of Nodites, Cutites and the Suntites. The end came in connection with violent activity of surrounding volcanoes and also the concurrent submergence of the Sicilian land bridge to Africa. The eastern floor of the Mediterranean Sea was gradually sinking, eventually carrying down beneath its waters the entire Adenic Peninsula over several hundred years. And so ended one of the most beautiful formations by the combination of man and nature ever witnessed on Urantia, Earth, Lemuria and Atlantis. There later developed the two great civilizations of Lemuria and Atlantis, although they were both not only to rise to a peak of high attainment, but eventually to descend slowly into dark ways through the temptations and influences of the dark forces beamed in from certain worlds of darkness within the galaxy. Both great civilizations were destined to finally sink beneath the oceans. The continent of Lemuria, situated in the Pacific Ocean, which included the continent of Australia and the Hawaiian Islands, although having gradually risen to great heights of spiritual development, was the first to finally sink beneath the waves. Some of its people did manage to escape through secret tunnels into the inner earth, thereby joining the 4D Argothian civilization within the interior. For more on that, the inner earth see link at the end of Book 1. Though Lemuria did achieve a relatively short-lived phase of high consciousness, most in that era were not truly in physical bodies, rather in devic-like etheric states, and did not face the difficulties required of the physical earth stage. Indeed, Lemuria never achieved the highly advanced technological development that later developed in the Golden Age of Atlantis. But, it was a time when gods walked with men, and all knew the joyful expression of a greater spiritual development, and was a time when many of Earth's people were known as the Star Children. The civilization of Atlantis first developed as a sister civilization near the latter period of Lemuria, and was situated in the Atlantic Ocean between the continents of Africa and South America and extending all the way up into the Northern Atlantic. Atlantis over time developed to great technological heights, developing many advanced technologies based on the use of crystals, including the ability to generate and distribute by crystal beamed power unlimited free electrical power through the atmosphere, and which also powered their airships and other surface transport. They enjoyed a golden age lasting over 40,000 years, only to then move into a slow decline in several stages, each marked with a progressive breakup and sinking of the original large continent in the Atlantic into several large island continents. This came around about 17,500 BC, which left it a large continental islands, the largest being Poseida, the second being Arion, plus three smaller ones, all in the North Atlantic. The present Azores Islands are a remnant of Poseida's highest mountainous areas. We take up the story after the second deluge of 17,500 BC, when the Utopian Golden Age subsided, and Atlantis split into five islands. The two major island continents were known as Poseida and Arion, with the third, Aug, being somewhat smaller. The two smallest islands were under the rule of the Arian race, and were known as Attalia and Aer. And so in the days after the second breakup of Atlantis, the benevolent government rule as a kingdom passed into the phase of a confederation-regional governments that ruled each of the islands. An aristocracy of sorts evolved that consisted of two opposing ideologies. The two major components of these were the Atlara scientist priesthood of the Law of One, based predominantly on the Isle of Poseida, and the Arian race of the Sons of Belial based on the Isle of Arian. The island of Arian was the most populated and exerted influence and political control over the smaller islands of Aug, Attalia and Aer. The Isle of Poseida was the planet's most potent vortex portal complex at the time of Atlantis. The Isle of Poseida housed the Temple of Healing, the Temple of Sound, the Temple of One, the Temple of Regeneration and the Temple of Knowledge. Poseida housed most of the major centers for higher learning. These were placed on Poseida because of its advantageous location within the geodesic grids and its proximity to beneficial electromagnetic energies that spiraled upward from the Earth's core. An incredibly potent healing spring flowed on Poseida, near the Temple of Healing, and its lore spawned the myths of the Fountain of Youth passed down by the indigenous peoples of Florida. It flows still into the oceans near Bimini. The Tall Ones, the golden race of Atlantis, of Pleiadian seed, were centered in Poseida, averaged 10 to 12 feet in stature. These were a gentle race of giants, involved in the cultural, artistic and educational pursuits in the heart of Atlantis. Poseida was also the headquarters and nucleus of the crystalline power grid and interdimensional tunnel system. The most advanced, complex and beautiful of the crystals were here. They were of Arcturian and Sirian Pleiadian construct, a living amalgam of many crystalline forms imbued with an alloy of platinum and gold. The crystals were housed in magnificent temples, some built of marble, others of crystalline sheets of beryl, corundum and diamond. The capital city of the island of Poseidon, also named Poseida, was called the Emerald City. Its bioplasmic field was projected into a shimmering glowing aurora of emerald green, visible for miles. The Atlanteans had perfected, with Arcturian technology, the ability to grow crystals of every structure and essence in an accelerated growth within the underground crystal beds of Arkansas, Tibet and Brazil, all being Atlantean colonies, accessed through the interdimensional tunnel system. Although much technology and quality of life had been lost in the first great breakup of Atlantis in 58,000 BC, technology still remained at an advanced level. Yet the harmony experienced in the Golden Age of Atlantis spiraled downward after the second breakup into islands in 17,500 BC as the islands grew into separately governed entities, which held to very differing ideologies in the initially chaotic and difficult period of reconstruction immediately after the breakup. Poseidon remained the contingency of the spiritual Law of One, while the people of Arion became gradually engrossed in power and materialism. Many of Earth's present-day people, Artists especially have great recall of the capital city of Atlantis, Poseida, termed the Emerald City because of the glowing green light dome projected over it. Some of Earth's artists in fact have made renditions of the city that are quite accurate. It was an exquisite marvel of architecture, culture and engineering, by far the most beautiful metropolis that has ever existed on Earth. It was breathtaking. The city was composed of a series of concentric walls and encircled by flowing sea-green canals. It was full of beautifully constructed temples, universities, theaters and museums. At the very center was a hill, and on top of the hill the majestic and stunning Temple of Poseidon, which was visible from everywhere in the Holy Emerald City. Inside the temple was a massive gold statue of the god of the sea, Poseidon, showing him driving 6-winged horses made of extraterrestrial platinum. The statue was embellished with precious gemstones of every color and type. The temple was octagonal and along each of the 8 walls were built convex enclosures with platforms for amazing crystals that stood 12 feet high and glowed like transparent diamonds. Poseida had been the least damaged of the major Atlantean cities after the breakup into islands, and was still of a very high frequency and quality of life. The Isle of Arion, populated by the Arian race, was the largest of the Atlantean islands and the most populated. Arion was the commercial center and yielded the most influence from the economic, agricultural and military perspective. After the second deluge, Arion was significantly damaged and the infrastructure required a chaotic stage of rebuilding. In the process, the state became controlled by an elitist, affluent white race, who gained control of the economy, military powers and the island's state government, even though the majority of the populace themselves were of the bronze or red race. From Arion grew a corrupt power-minded aristocracy who sought to block the law of one and utilize Atlantis's technology for control of the world, this through the utilization of crystalline energy for weaponry, and use of genetic science for development and retention of an inferior race to serve as workers and soldiers. The Poseidon-Arion Rift. The use of genetically engineered servant classes developed on the Isle of Arion led to the Great Rift between the Atlara priesthood-led Poseidons following the Law of One and the Arians known as the Sons of Belial, whose leaders followed their own secret dark motivations. The Arians were to become so engrossed and hardened in the materialistic ambitions of the industrial machine that they lost sight of the spiritual ethics that had prevailed over the continent of Atlantis in the Golden Era. Literally hundreds of thousands of hybrid human mutations were created to work the fields and monstrosities were created with controlled minds to robotically do the bidding of their masters. The agro-industrial society of Arion became quite dependent on them. For several millennia the two ideologies of Poseida and the Arians remained headlocked over this issue and governmental agencies were in a state of delicate impasse. The Poseidons were far too cultured and gentle in nature to attempt to fight the Arians and sought to educate them and spiritually influence them into changing their ways. The Arians, who outnumbered the Poseidons 3-1, dared not attack Poseida lest they might have the crystalline energy that powered the nation shut off. In the interim, outbreaks of war erupted between the Arian-controlled Atlantean military as the former colonies of Atlantis located in the Mediterranean areas broke traditional ties and developed their own independent governments. The colonies, particularly those in Greece and Turkey, saw the change from the utopian Atlantis to the military fascist state controlled by the Arians and sought to break away. Although the Arians had the military edge, the Mediterranean states did not succumb, and regional colonial wars raged on with neither side able to dominate the other. Factions among Arians increasingly sought to use crystal energy to quell the adversaries. This was firmly refused by the Atlara and Law of One populace of Poseida. Several futile attempts to terrorize the Poseidons were attempted by the Arians, and each was quelled. The Poseidons retaliated by shutting down the crystal-fed power systems and thus negating the Arians. The Arians responded by stopping food supply and manufactured goods. A great impasse ensued. In a great deceptive scheme, disguised as a plan for unification, The Aryans approached the Poseidons with the formation of a renewed national congress to work out their growingly tense differences and bring harmony to Atlantis. Representatives from the Poseidon Law of One were sent along with the representatives from the Aryan Sons of Belial. The congress was formalized with an equal amount of representation from the two parties. Within short order, a federation of sorts was sanctified with the promise of greater harmony. It appeared for several decades that the promise of change and betterment might come about from the new national congress. The Poseidons were encouraged and many of them let down their guard. The Atlara scientist priesthood remained wary of the Aryan motives and sensed deception. Initially, the National Congress did improve relations and many minor superficial laws that promised unity were set in motion.